You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 29th of October to the 4th of November 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove, David Matthews and Chris Havergal, and books editor Karen Shook. Is industry funding undermining trust in science? Following a series of exposés, David has been looking into the conflicts of interest that can undermine research. Karen will give us the full lowdown as ever on our books section. A leading university is developing analytical tools to monitor academics' performance. Should you be afraid? Chris will fill you in a little bit more on what that's all about in a second. The Research Council grant success rates are out. David has the top lines on that story. And what's it like to have James Bond as your lecturer? Jack will let us know, if not what it's exactly like, perhaps a close approximation of what it could be like. Stay tuned for that. But first, our cover story this week, David, is one of your features. It looks at industry funding and how it might undermine trust in science.
Yes, readers may have noticed since the summer there have been quite a few big headlines, both sides of the Atlantic, about industry funding of scientific research and how this might introduce conflicts of interest and undermine the findings and more broadly trust in science. So we've had the Times recently had a big front page story about Coca-Cola funding healthy eating initiatives to counter claims that its drinks help us cause obesity. Mm. The New York Times did a sort of similar thing with Coca-Cola, again them funding research that suggested, you know, actually it's more about what you, how you exercise rather than what you eat and drink. The New York Times also had a long piece as well, I think appeared on the front cover, about scientists being employed by both sides of the genetically modified organisms lobby to try and tip public debates. So there's been a kind of upsurge in these kind of stories recently. So I kind of go through what's happened recently and also look at some of the evidence on all of this. And it kind of has quite a long pedigree. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have seen the it's a brilliant documentary called Inside Job in 2010 about the financial crisis. And that really, it kind of really skewers lots of American economists for completely failing to warn about build up of toxic debt in the US economy, while at the same time, you know, taking huge amounts from investment banks and so on for speaking fees, consultancy and so on. And I mean, there has been some, you know, there's so many areas you can look at in this, but in economics there's a paper that looks at prominent economists and whether they disclose their conflicts of interest, and there does appear to have been some improvement since the financial crisis, but still the vast majority of prominent economists, as paper suggests, in the US are, you know, have sidelines, you know, working for banks, having their own companies, even after the financial crisis.
It's interesting, isn't it? I know, Jack, you had a story recently about a kids' company. It was your work that uncovered the fact that a report they quoted quite a lot in defending their actions had, in fact, received quite a large amount of funding, I think, from the charity itself.
Yeah, that was right, actually. And, I mean, you could say there's nothing wrong with charities funding research and reports and audits into their work, but I have to say, when I saw some of the language used in the report in which the principal investigator was eulogising over Camilla Bakman-Gelidge and saying what a privilege and pleasure and how she was so struck by her wonderful work, and that was just the introduction, and you know, you just thought
something's afoot.
Is this going to be as sort of maybe tough and clear-sighted as it really needs to be?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, in all of this, scientists and researchers like to believe that they are objective seekers after truth. And, you know, it's actually quite psychologically tough to maybe accept that this can sway your judgment. But actually, I looked into the sort of social psychology of all of this, and the evidence does seem pretty clear. Even if you receive something relatively small,
a free pen was the
example given, or you know, a nice conference of the weekend to, you know, a sunny West Coast resort, as US medical doctors often take, you get a sense of indebtedness, and it's something over which you don't have much control. And actually, one of the more shocking things I found in this is often disclosure of interest is seen as a remedy. So, okay, I've done this report, but it was funded by X company. End of story. But actually, it's not all right. And in fact, it might make the problem worse, because then you've as one researcher puts it, you've got a moral license to exaggerate your findings.
Yeah, I recall. I mean, it's a journalistic question as well, isn't it? In many ways, I've been flown out to a few conferences in my time to cover. One from a few years back, I won't say where, but I wrote a very honest piece. I thought about the country in which this conference took place, and I was contacted shortly after saying, you know, why we flew you out there. We thought we might get sort of more positive coverage than what you've given it.
I've had a similar experience. Yeah. But I think you can kind of look back on these things. Yeah, as a journalist or academic, and think, yeah, I actually did a really good job. I wasn't swayed. But actually, I think the evidence in social psychology is we don't know when we're swayed. This is the problem we have. Our brain is fooled in all kinds of ways that we're not totally aware of. There's a great book from a couple of years ago, Daniel Kahneman, who's Thinking Fast and Slow, which is absolutely brilliant. It shows just how bad we are at realising when we've been influenced in a kind of irrational, unobjective way. And I think this is something scientists are going to have to look at. I mean, academics and scientists, as you'll see from stats in the piece, are still pretty well trusted, both sides of the Atlantic. That's the good news. Far more trusted than journalists, far more trusted than civil servants. But could this change if we get more of these headlines? Well, we'll have to see.
Yeah, page 36 in the magazine for that feature. Also available, of course, on timeshighereducation.com. Moving on, our book section this week. Karen, what's in store?
This week, Fred Ingalls reviews Dominic Sandbrook's latest book, Dominic Sandbrook, the incredibly prolific historian. It's been said that some of his books covering the 1970s take approximately as long to read as they did to happen in the first place. This book is The Great British Dream Factory, The Strange History of Our National Imagination. And it covers everything from Billy Elliot as a self-improvement narrative to Sandbrook's own great icon, Margaret Thatcher. Also this week, Ruth Richardson reviews Christine Corton's book, London Fog, the biography. So for anyone who's ever spoken to someone from another country who asks you earnestly how the London fog is, and you try to avoid saying you haven't seen one since 1928, this tells us everything we need to know about pea soupers, London particulars. I'm not sure how particular they were, but particular enough to have a name. And she gives us a look at how it's presented in literature, but also a historical chronology from the Stuart era to the Clean Air Acts of the 1950s to 1990s. This book has been a while in the making, and it's one of Harvard's lead titles for the autumn, and it was highly commended by our reviewer, Richardson. Also this week, Helen Bynum looks at Melinda Baldwin's book, Making Nature, the History of a Scientific Journal. The journal in question, obviously, is Nature, the one that was founded in 1869, and it's had the services of just 7 editors. They are long-lived. Also famous for being the place that Watson and Crick's paper on the structure of DNA was published in April 1953. And Helen Bynum, our reviewer, talks about the fact that not all of the archives for the journal are available, but there are plenty of stories in this book that talk about the arguments and discussions that went on, and in particular for people who look at letters pages or comments below the line as being the home of crackpots and time wasters. The author makes the argument that it is in the comments, the correspondence columns in Nature, that science was really advanced. People talking not just about the fact being wrong or not liking the cut of someone's jib, but discussing science more generally.
And we do, of course, encourage people to comment on THE's website. We would never deem them to be crackpots.
Absolutely not. Of course, I was talking about other publications. Which shall all remain nameless. Also this week, Danny Dorling reviews a book by Nancy Kwok called A World of Homeowners, American Power and the Politics of Housing Aid, the American initiative since the 1930s to encourage other countries to give government funding for private housing and to essentially privatize the housing market, starting in Manila and running through pretty much everywhere else in the rest of the world. And he argues, landing back here, it was a policy that was designed to counter in the Cold War the socialistic housing policy of Britain in 1946, one that our reviewer argues is not much in evidence anymore. And our book of the week is on Stalin's team. If you ever wondered whether, you know, did team building exercises go on in the dictatorship of the Soviet Union? Well, the good news is that they didn't really need to do so because Stalin kept his mates close to them, all of whom continued to wear a kind of revised version of military garb after they bonded in the war. And, well, the ones who survived were very fast friends. Of course, it's been argued that this this may be a slightly selective post hoc look at things because, of course, we're not hearing about the ones who just got roped out of the pictures. This is another fantastic book from Sheila Fitzpatrick, an extremely eminent scholar of Soviet history. And the subtitle calls it The Years of Living Dangerously in Soviet Politics. And I think everyone can guess just how dangerous that was. This book focuses on the ones who more or less survived.
Page 46 for all those reviews this week. And of course, click the books tab on our website if you want to read them online. A leading UK university, Chris, says it's developing analytical tools to monitor academics' performance. Now, this came out of a round table that was commissioned by JISC, hosted by Times Higher Education. There's the declaration from our earlier piece about any vested interest.
Very good, Chris.
I hope your report...
It's a nice pen you've got.
Yeah. I hope your report wasn't swayed in any way, of course, by that. But some interesting things discussed there.
Yeah, it was a wide-ranging discussion looking at the role of technology in the future of higher education, and one of the key trends coming out of that was the use of analytical tools, mainly, it should be said, around students. And that's where, you know, a lot of people think there's scope for use of analytical tools to identify students who may be at risk of dropping out or struggling by measuring, for example, their library attendance, engagement with the virtual learning environment, and so on. The interesting point, which I've picked up on in this article by Gavin McLaughlin, who's the Chief Information Officer and Librarian at the University of Edinburgh, is that this approach, looking at students, is, in his words, only half the story. And what he has outlined is, at Edinburgh, how they're looking to develop tools to monitor the performance of academics. The example he gave, and where you could perhaps see it being applied first of all, is in terms of marking and feedback of student work. For example, the quality, length, detail of those responses, but also the timeliness of those responses. How this sort of approach will go down with academics remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Be very afraid if you tend to be tardy when it comes to getting your papers back to your students. The splash this week we should cover before we move on. David, it's you again. It's an annual piece in a THE. We cover it year in, year out. The Research Council grant success rates. What do they tell us this year?
Basically, the top line on this is that applications have increased substantially to the Research Councils in 2014-15, and that's an increase. I think it's the first increase in about at least 6 years. The overall headline success rate still stands at about 28%, but actually, at 5 out of the 6 Research Councils, it's gone down quite significantly. And for example, at the ESRC, it's down to 12%. And quite a few, it's dipping towards 20%. And I mean, the real problem here is that the research councils and other experts agree, once you get down to, you know, just 1 in 5 applications being accepted, the whole exercise becomes kind of, you know, seriously problematic, because you get demotivated applicants. You have overstretched reviewers from the research councils who can't do a good enough job assessing all these things, and the whole it just doesn't become worth your while as a researcher to bid for money. So we're almost at that level for 25% or below for 5 out of 6 now, and 1 at 12%. So whether these might go to, you know, the applications might drop off next year. And as we go towards the next ref, maybe they'll drop again as people start writing up. But it's not looking good.
It's all covered on page 6 and 7 this week. There's far too much to go into here. Several tables for you to get your teeth into. Obviously, you can display these figures in so many ways. We've done a decent job, I think, this week, and you'll find them online too as well, of course. Before we go, I said at the start of the podcast, possibly loosely hanging this feature off the release of Spectre, the latest James Bond film, that Jack, you have some experience of being taught by the special agent himself.
Yes, this was a little over a decade ago. Before I became a journalist, I was actually a film extra in a movie starring Daniel Craig, and it took place at UCL, and I was one of Daniel Craig's students, sitting in an sociology lecture he was giving that day, and I listened to Daniel Craig for the best part of about 8 hours.
We should know he wasn't in fact Bond at this point, was he?
He was named as Bond, I think, maybe the year after or 2 years after. So this is...
Signs were already there, though,
signs
obviously.
Signs were already there, but I thought Daniel Craig was a very convincing lecturer. I'd just done 3 years of a degree, and when I stepped into the classroom, Daniel Craig, he was a fantastic sociology lecturer, and I think, you know, I think, you know, if James Bond or Daniel Craig ever wanted to sort of have a second career, I think they could very successfully transition into the world of academia, although it might not be as glamorous or sexy as his current incarnation as 007.
And what's the film? Can we witness you?
The film is Enduring Love, and...
Ian McKeown.
And not only was Daniel Craig in it, but also Ben Whishaw, who is the... current Q. He was one of my fellow students in the classroom that day.
Jack, you are an extra in yet another production involving Ben Whishaw.
I've been in Nathan Barley. I'm also star. I'll also let you in another secret. Not only have I been Daniel Craig's student, I was also when he was playing Ted Hughes in another film, I was also a fellow contemporary of his at Cambridge in a single scene. Yet again, I failed to make the final cut.
There you go. Well, good luck to any research council. Good luck to any research councils that turned down a grant application for the bomb. That's all I can say. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You can read all about Jack's extra work in a blog that he's written about that. It's not in the magazine, but it is in our blog section online. If you do want to comment on any of the stories that we've spoken about today or anything covered in our magazine, then you can do so at timeshighereducation.com. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn too. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.